And then since a game is either put out in book form or box form, why not put art on it? You got a blank space there. And that should help sell it. Now, if you get art so bad that it turns people off, then of course you shouldn't even put a cover on it. I've seen a few games like that. Even better if they put a white cover on and just put the name of the game, because the art was so bad that it hindered it. But if you can get a hold of a decent artist and do something exciting that sort of gives some reference to the game itself, it helps sell. It helps sell a game.
I definitely agree with that. Art makes a huge difference if I'm going to get into a game or not. There's been many times I've overlooked games that I might have, been fantastic games, but because the art was just bad so art. Bad on it, I just completely overlook it. I was telling Larry a story last night about how when I got into reading, I was 18 years old, and it was the cover of the book that drew me in. I judged the book by its cover, and that opened up the whole world to me. So I think cover art is absolutely critical to the sales, at least.
Speaking from my own experience, which is vastly more on the consumer side, if it's a game that I already know that I want, say Fantasy Hero, which Mr. Elmore did the cover for, which is
the fourth edition version.
Yeah, which was just beautiful.
Yeah, I love that.
Okay. It was a fantastic cover, but I was going to buy that book anyway. At the same time, Hero System 5th Edition, which I was going to buy anyway, I think has one of the worst covers I've ever seen, but I bought it anyway. So for things you were going to buy anyway, it doesn't really matter. Now, I have bought games that I knew nothing about based only on the cover, and in many cases, they're just absolutely terrible. But I bought them because the cover was neat. World of Cinnabar, which is notorious for being a horrible, horrible game. The version of it, the edition I bought, had a pretty striking cover on it, which I... There have been other games that I've accidentally picked up that I might not have seen had not the cover been interesting, that were actually good. So I think it's important, but mainly for things, in my consumer opinion, for things that I don't already know about.
All right, can you hear me? Yep. I'm going to ramble on a bit more at length here, I think. As a general principle, I think absolutely yes, art is crucial for most gaming books. And as proof of that, look at the past several years' worth of Origins Award and any award winners in the major award categories, certainly. Every single one of them is a hardcover, full-color book. And they win not because they are inherently better as games, but because they present better and therefore attract more attention. It's art draws attention. From a publishing standpoint, and this sort of dovetails with what you were saying, Brendan, some books really require art, and some books can get by without it. For example, we've published some Hero System Advanced Rules books that are nothing but rules, and we just deliberately put no art in them. And our fans don't care because they're supposed to be rules reference books. On the other hand, if you've got a book where you are presenting a lot of characters, or where you are presenting a setting, particularly an unusual setting like, say, Jerun or Tekumel, you've got to have art to convey to the reader and the fans what is this weird thing you're trying to do when they have no cultural reference point. If you tell somebody, I've got knights and wizards, we can envision that. But if you tell somebody, this is a culture based on Malaysian, Mayan, Chinese, and Babylonian folklore, you had better show them what you're dealing with, because they're not going to know. Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing? I don't know. We've gotten by for thousands of years, or hundreds of years, with novels dealing with weird topics, and novels don't have illustrations. Role-playing games always had illustrations just because the earliest role-playing games started putting them in and everybody followed along. I think there are an awful lot of game books that don't require any illustration, and the need to pay for the illustrations is a crippling factor in staying in business, because the art is often the single most expensive thing other than the printing, and sometimes it's more than the printing. But for better or worse, that is the world we live in, and it has certainly gotten us some absolutely fantastic art in these books that can then go on and be published in art books. There's an art book for The Art of Shadowrun. Larry's just kickstarted a wonderful book collecting 20 or 30 years worth of his work, almost all of which was either for gaming or gaming related novels. So in the long run, it's provided us with this, you know, fantastic resource to fuel our imaginations. So I say, you know, more power to it.
I think the D&D sort of kicked it all off in gaming. Well, it was great art that would have sold it off. The early in D&D did not have great art at all. It was a hindrance almost. But the people that played it, the word of mouth got around so quick that it was unbelievable game system. So it had art, although bad. But then again, there was a situation where the game was so great that it didn't make any difference. They could have sold it in a brown paper bag once it got going. But I agree with him. If it's just pure rules stuff, you don't need it. Because you're selling to gamers that already know what's going on. They're looking for the nuts and bolts. And presenting a new game, for example, it's like, I know when I worked at TSR, we were playing AD&D. I knew they was going to, I guess it's second edition, I knew they was going to do new hardback books, new boxes for all the games, for D&D and AD&D. I really wanted to do the hardback books, the AD&D books. And they decided that my art was more mass market, so I did the box covers, which were in Toys R Us. And Jeff Beasley did the hardback covers. His art looked more hobby related. But I got to do some interiors for the hardbacks. And I did the interiors for the box covers. I had more people comment over the years gone by that this one female cleric and a female archer, I did drawings of, and maybe it's basic rules book or something, that they were about 14 years old when they bought, and they loved that character. They remember those drawings, you know, 40 years later, just about, they remember them. It stuck in their mind. I wish I had to hold on to those. I sold those drawings years ago for almost nothing. Those drawings of that little female cleric could have sold for a fortune right now. I've had people with big money say, do you still have that drawing? Oh, no. I haven't paid anything for it. Oh, I'm sorry.
If Brandon doesn't mind my usurping his role for 1 second here, just as a sort of a point of curiosity, what is the first gaming book each of you remember that struck you on the basis of the art, regardless of whether you liked the game? What's the first game where you remember? Because you're right, early D&D, the art was not particularly good, and in the early, branching off from D&D and gaming, the art still wasn't particularly good because everybody was working on a shoestring budget. So what was the first game book you remember where the art really struck you as good, professional, attractive work? Aside from your own.
I'm trying to remember. I know I've done so many covers for different things. I can't remember. Right now, I can't think. I remember one game, but I can't remember what game it was. I didn't buy it because I got to the point shortly in my career. I didn't have time to play games. But I'd seen some covers of one that just had this big kick-ass monster on the front just coming at you. And that wasn't that many years ago. I can't remember the name of the game, but it's like, wow, that made me want to play that game, you know, if it's that exciting. And it looked like it was a cross between, it's like science fantasy. Well, I can't remember it. But it was, I know it was at least, book size. It wasn't kind of anything. But there's been some covers, like I said, that just blew me away. I can't remember some of the games because it got to where I couldn't play games. Mm-hmm. I can't even play computer games. I don't own a computer game. But then my career would come to an end because I get addicted to them, man. All right. It's like you're an alcoholic and you can't have alcohol in the house, so I've kept it out, you know.
With me, I do remember the very first edition ones. They were just, I remember the Dungeon Master's Guide had this, I think it was a demon. Or
it was
a
Nefrede.
Oh, Nefrede, that's what it was. It was just horrible. I still have it at home. And when Advance came out, I was really impressed with the covers. But the first books that came out that really grabbed my attention were, I think it was Tony DiTerlizzi. He did the Planescape books. And it was so different than...
Yeah.
You know, we were so used to seeing the paintings on the cover and stuff like that. It really stood out for me that it was such a different looking thing. And every page he had these illustrations. I remember there was a creature called a Marut, and it just really stood out to me. His work with the sigil box set and stuff like that. That's the one that I first remember really grabbing me.
When did those come out?
Had it been early 90s?
Very early 90s. Yeah, I don't know that your Planescape actually came out. It might even have been 89, but it was very, very early 90s.
Yeah.
If you don't recognize Tony DiTralizzi's name, he's the guy who did the art for the Spiderwick Chronicles. If you have kids, you might recognize that more than Planescape. As far as covers go, my earliest memories of like really striking, beautiful covers were pretty much all Larry Elmore work. Like the aforementioned 4th edition Fantasy Hero was just beautiful.
Yeah, that Shadowveer versus Bakva, I love that cover. I could look at it for just hours.
That was just beautiful.
Shadowveer versus Bakva, oh, yeah. The guy on the horse with the lance.
Yeah. As far as interior artwork, the first game that I... Because in the early days of gaming, it was basically line art in the early days. Some was very good, and some was just not really as good, you know. But and art's so personal anyway. But the first game that I remember flipping through the interior art and having it really be striking to me was Vampire. Because the fellow whose his name slips my mind.
Tim Bradstreet.
The Tim Bradstreet interior illustrations for Vampire really evoked that setting to me.
And I think that sort of helped kick off the whole vampire movement.
It not only did that, but it helped really kickstart White Wolf. And here's the amazing thing about that. He wasn't a known artist at the time. They paid him scale, game industry scale, for those illustrations. Yeah. Almost nothing, in other words. And you went on to make a fortune selling t-shirts and things, but he, conversely, went on to become incredibly well-known. So it worked out really well for both of them.
Yeah.
For me, the book that I first remember looking at and being just really struck by the art was Shadowrun First Edition. It had a gorgeous Larry Elmore cover and these beautiful color interior plates by Jeff Lobenstein that were very stylized. He has a specific style of art. It's easy to recognize. And that just struck me and sort of influenced my view of the game. And there again, that's a perfect example of a setting that needs some illustration because it's unusual. You know, you don't normally associate elves and orcs and trolls with cyberpunk. In fact, when I first heard of the concept of the game, I'm like, yeah, right, this is going to work. So that was just, it just really caught my eye. It's the first time I remember just flipping through a book looking at the illustration.
Now let's get back on the artist side. Let's say for Shadowrun, I remember that really well. They called me out, they wanted a cover, and they wanted it like in a week. Brand new game.
Yeah.
An oil painting. Week. Can you give me more time? But we want you to do it. And so I said, I'll do it. I'll do it small. Because the painting wasn't but about that tall. And I only charged him $1,500 because it was small. I didn't know it was Shadowrun. I mean, yeah, Shadowrun is still around today in different
forms. It is, then, and it's like, and they're about to release a 5th edition, I believe.
So I do it. When I turned it into him, I said, I don't want you, this is not going to be reproduced very large. He said, no, it's just going to go on a, this size. So for the size of the painting, it's going to reduce, make it tighter. So, and then the city buildings back there, I just sort of slapped a man rough. And he said, this giant logo is going to go in there, that big horn thing. And so, this is good, okay. So I said, just please don't reproduce this really big because it's a small painting and it'll really fall apart, I think, when you blow it up really big. Don't worry, we won't. About a month later, Gen Con. So I walk into Gen Con, and the ceilings of the place are probably 20 feet, 30, who knows, huge. I walk in, the first thing I see is in the room, the cover blown up, probably 15 feet tall.
In banner.
Yeah, giant banner, like, oh my God. But the good thing about it is you usually viewed it, 40 feet away.
Distance,
so even when you look at it, it only looked about that big, from a distance. So it looked pretty tight. So it worked. But when I first walked this, I thought, oh my God, they said they weren't going to blow it up. That's size of a tractor trailer, It's like,
yeah, for years at the Fossil would take a big row of booths along one wall in the gen, and they had a banner about as long as this wall.
Like a building.
And 30 or 40 feet tall, showing this aerial view, you know, sort of three-quarter isometric view of Shadowrun Seattle viewed, you know, from the 3D perspective with, you know, there's a dragon flying around. There's all, it was the most gorgeous thing. I've wanted to do that ever since for some property of mine, but it must have cost, I don't know, $10,000-$20,000 to create it. And then to pay somebody to hang it and store it every time is thousands of dollars more, but it was the most striking single banner I've ever seen at 20 years of going to Gen Con.
Yeah. I knew I'd sell the Shadowrun painting too low because they paid me $1,500 for it. And then the next day, after they got it, I forget now the owner of Vasa called me up and said,
Jordan Weissman?
Yeah. He said, I'll pay you $1,500 for the original. I said, okay, so that means I could at least get $3,000 out of the deal. So I sold the original for $1,500. Now I wish I had the original back, God, you know, except for a lot more. But you live and learn.
Yeah, exactly. You never know.
The days of 40 foot long, 20 foot tall role playing game banners have kind of come and gone.
Yeah, TSR, or Wizards doesn't do their big castle in the middle of a floor anymore that they used to do back in the 90s. It's just, these things grow and change.
It's a waste of money.
Yeah, the thousands and thousands of dollars I had to spend just to store that thing and then to pay people to set it up. Now, it was fun. It used to be that Wizards, or TSR before them, they would take the center block in the dealer's room at Gen Con, and their booth was this giant, you know, foam castle. You know, resin castle, and you know, of course, it had built-in recesses for setting up, you know, the counters to sell the games and things, and to set up tables to run demos. But it was gorgeous, and of course, it put everything else in the hall of shame. But the tradition was then on Sunday before the dealer's room opened, the rest of us would load up on Nerf weapons and assault the castle.
Yep.
And they would defend it with their own Nerf weapons.
Yeah, that was like a tradition.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, that kind of ties into something that I actually don't know, so I will be learning things along with you. The days of doing that kind of came to an end when Magic the Gathering eviscerated the role-playing game industry. Overnight, you went from those kinds of presentations to companies going out of business left and right,
yep.
And people all over the Gen Con floor playing Magic. Now, that wasn't great for publishers, but I'm curious, and I'd like to know, was it good for artists? Because
some of them, a
deck of cards, every single card in some people's decks is an original piece of art.
Right before Magic came out, Wizards of the Coast came to me. There's six employees. They want me to do some work for them. They didn't know what, just some kind of a project for me to think about it and them to think about it. And they were so honest, they gave me a financial breakdown of the company. I had $6,000 in the bank. And so I had about $6,000 in the bank. Thought, well, they're no better off than me. This little company. They're like, what could we do together? Well, so I just sort of drug my feet, and I was busy and didn't think about it. So the next Gen Con, they came to me and said, look, we've got this new game, and we need tons of art, but we don't have any money. I knew they didn't have any money. They said, so would you do some paintings for free? I can't do them for free because it's not very big paintings, you know. And I said, I can't do them for free. I got bills to pay, a wife and kids, and house payment, car payments. They said, well, we can pay $10 a painting. I went, I mean, I can't do $10 paintings. Well, we didn't think you could, but we wanted to ask. We'd like, but we need a lot of art. So I asked Keith Parkinson. He said, no, I can't do that. So they couldn't get any pros because it's just no money or...
I know they ended up paying some of the artists who did the first deck. They paid them with shares in the company.
Well, that they offered
and
me
those
that.
Guys ended up becoming extremely wealthy, as it turned out.
Well, they offered me shares of the company and royalties. Well, that was a rule of thumb was, that's a way to never get paid.
Yeah.
Okay. So I go, no. And all the other pros, no. So they had a lot of artists trying to break in. So a lot of artists, I know artists that did 100 of them for free. Okay. Or $5 a painting. Well, one artist friend of mine, he's a pretty good painter, but he was really trying to break in, and he did tons of it. His first royalty check, he bought a home in Denver. This, when they sold to Hasbro a few years later, his check was $900,000. And then he got another separate check that was something like $400,000 on just Pokemon royalties. I mean, they got royalties in everything in those early contracts. Well, I missed the boat. Well, I was pissed. I wasn't going to do any magic cards ever because I'd screwed myself in the ground. Well, I could have been a millionaire if I had done a bunch of those. Well, then, of course, they changed their contract, you know, once they got smart. So, but still, it was $1,000 a painting, you know. And they'd call me up, I'd say no. Finally, I found out that every friggin' artist I knew just about, a friend of mine, had done magic cards. So I think all total, I might have done 15 magic cards. I'd take a few, mainly landscapes, because I could paint them really quick with $1,000. But I'm still pissed because I missed the whole boat. Those are the things when hindsight's 20/20, you know. But yeah, that is a weird, but magic, like you said, put companies out of business, that miniatures companies put out of business, Ralph Arthur out of business.
Yeah.
Because hobby stores, when they'd order their monthly supplies of stuff, games and everything, they didn't order anything but magic because it was selling off the shelves, so.
And it was easier than keeping track of inventory.
Yeah, you just stick them up, they're gone. And so they quit carrying other stuff, and companies went broke. I know I had the misfortune to have one year my booth was pretty close to the Magic Gathering where they're selling the stuff. Okay, the whole time long I had this gigantic line right in front of my booth. Nobody could even get into it. It never ended, this line. I was my worst Gen Con ever. Then the next year, I got across the aisle from them, so people wasn't blocking my booth. But what happened is, it was one of my best years because all the people waiting in line, they was waiting there, they'd be looking across the aisle on my art. And of course they'd pay for their stuff. I was right at the cash register. Of course they'd pay for it, they'd try and look at my art and buy a piece sometimes. So one year it killed me, next year it really did good, you know, because there's a constant flow, you know, of people. But it upset the apple cart really big time in the gaming world. Changed everything.
Have you done any collectible art, anything like that?
Yeah, most of the stuff I do is like limited print run type stuff. I wouldn't call it collectible necessarily, but
somebody's collecting it.
Yeah, somebody's buying it. Not a lot of people, but yeah, I just do want to say something more about the whole magic thing. I remember that time. It was short. It was probably about 5 or 6 years after I just got into role playing, and I remember I had a hatred for Wizards of the Coast at the time. I was a TSR guy. I loved everything about it. I loved the miniatures. I loved the games. I loved everything about it. And when that happened, and I had friends starting to play Magic, I said, I will never do it. I'll never do it. And, you know, they finally reeled me in eventually. But I just, that time in gaming was such a transitional time. It was, you know, it's almost like a turning of the age in a sense. So, but yeah, collectible art. Yeah, it's just my stuff, really, that I do for, you know, for shows and stuff. So.
On the business end of things, like, he's talking about how royalties are basically shorthand for not being paid. And as somebody who's certainly not hired as many artists as Steve has, but as artists I've worked with, that's across the board. Nobody wants to work for free. And they shouldn't.
Right.
You know, it takes him just as long to, well, anyway. But have you missed any things that 99.9 times out of 100, it was the right decision to say no to, and you said no to something and it wound up blowing up and you could have bought a house?
I thankfully haven't had too many of those, and most of them haven't, you know, things that I've passed over for free or for, you know, beans, you know, really haven't amounted to anything. I've been fortunate in the sense that I haven't had to look back and kick myself. Most of the time I stick to that rule, unless it's for a cause. I'll sometimes donate art to, for example, there's a organization out of Lynchburg that does, it's a motorcycle group for alcoholics and stuff like that they've gotten together. So once a year I'll donate something to them, but they're not really making a profit off anything anyway. So thankfully I haven't had one of those magic stories to tell.
That's my only one, is magic.
Yeah. Yeah, who could have saw that coming?
No. True.
Right. Oh, no, absolutely. They made the right decision by any sane measure. It's just that sometimes you win the lottery. Most of the times the lottery wins you.
Yeah. Do you remember the Gen Con magic yet? Because I remember it clearly.
It was my first Gen Con, 1993, 20 years ago. And I remember seeing these lines. And I'm like, what the hell is this? So I finally went up, and I was at the time living in Greenville, North Carolina, which, you know, I didn't even have a gaming group. I had a friend of mine lived in New Bern, and we'd get together occasionally, you know. But I didn't have a regular gaming group, so I really wasn't that concerned. But I went and I bought one regular pack and one booster pack each for me and my friend. Think, well, we can play one-on-one. We never did play. He went on and played. I never played Magic the Gathering, and thank God, because I would have sunk so much money into it. But I still have those two decks and two boosters. Sadly, none of the alpha generation cards in them are really valuable ones. But at some point, I should just dig them out and sell them to somebody, because I'm not going to do anything with them. But yeah, maybe there's a Mox in here. Maybe there's something really valuable. No. But yeah, I remember distinctly these lines sneaking, like there's a cutting off booths, because they hadn't planned for it. They didn't know it was going to be take off at that level. They hoped, of course, but they didn't know. And after that, anytime somebody had a big event or something they thought was going to be big or new was going to involve a line, they would arrange it so that the line would snake out and go around the wall of the dealer's room so as not to inconvenience the booth, because it's an incredible frustration when you're paying hundreds of dollars for this booth space and no one can get at it. You have to earn a certain amount every day on average or to cover your expenses, or you're going to lose money, except to the extent you think of it as an advertising expense and therefore justified regardless. But most companies I know, I can't afford to do that. I've got to make money at Gen Con. I've got to, because sales at Gen Con come directly to me, 100% of cover price, no distributor discount, no retailer discount, no nothing, no shipping cost, me.
And who was it that invented, was Garfield?
Richard Garfield was the one who invented Magic the Gathering. The joke is they said, we need him to keep him around because he's easy to figure out who owes what for pizza. So, hey, Richard, while you're at it, just design us a unique and interesting game that nobody's ever done before that'll make us a fortune. Sure.
Prior to that, the big claim to fame for Wizards of the Coast, Robo Rally.
And the Primal Order, the book about playing gods.
Yeah, and that had some kind of weird TSR controversy.
It caused a big legal battle, not because of TSR, but because in the back they put stats for different games. It's about how to play gods and demigods and use them in your games, and it's quite a good product. But in that day and age, the gaming industry was still fairly small. Everybody knew everybody, and usually you could put other people's stats in your games and they were okay with it because it helped sales. But Wizards put, Rifts or Palladium role-playing stats in it without asking Kevin Symbieta's permission, and his lawyers were on them like a duck on a June bug, and it became a big problem, and it was just about to put them out of business. Then Mike Pondsmith from Artel Saurian Games was called in to mediate the situation, basically, and a settlement was worked out. But that just about killed them right there, and that was one of the reasons they didn't have money to pay artists, because they were working on a shoestring budget by that point. But yeah, because it was a rookie mistake. It happens, and as luck would have it, they kind of bounced back.
I know when Magic was at its peak, I was at a convention, I think in Canada, and of course, everybody was Magic. Everything was pretty low-key, except where the Magic booth was at, and everybody's going crazy. And this guy walks by and stands there and talks to me for a while, and he said, "You really like my art." Talked a long time. It seemed like he knew a little bit about art, and I asked him, what did he do? He said, "Well, I'm a bit of a game designer and stuff." And he walked on away, and crazy he left. A friend of mine comes up behind me and said, "You know who that was?" I go, "No." So it was
Richard Garfield.
Richard Garfield. I said, "So, who's he?" "He made Magic the Gathering." I go, "Oh, okay, that's why he's cool." But he was really laid back out. Yeah. And I just think here he was. The game he made, they brought in with the armored car. They was releasing all these new packs. And they went up on a balcony and with security guards and started throwing these packs on this balcony. And it was like a riot. People were for free. People were running. And I was sitting like, I've never seen anything like this in my life. It's crazy.
Let me throw out a question to sort of divert us from Magic a bit. From my perspective as a game publisher, I have to write art lists for books. I buy a lot of art. It's one of my least favorite tasks, but it's also one of the most necessary to spec out the art. What do you guys as artists like to see in a client who is commissioning art? How do you like detailed descriptions? Do you like very undetailed descriptions that give you a lot of creative freedom? What do you like to see in and what I would call an art list or an art spec?
Well, and let's say I'm doing paperback book covers. I like as much freedom as they can give me. I'll read the manuscript and then try to do something that gives me, try to think something I like. Now, when it comes to a game and characters or monsters that are going to be in the game, I want a detailed description because I don't want you fighting some monster and I do some version that's just crazy. And the monster in the game is nothing like that, you know. So I try to reflect my gaming art as close to the stats or descriptions that's in the game. Now, there's times when the gaming company doesn't have a lot of money, but they want a good piece of art, and they'll come to me, and I've done this a lot. I sell them second rights on another painting I've done that wasn't on a game, so they can get a fresh new painting that sort of, if it's exciting enough, it's got a group, like a party in it, that could reflect at least gameplay, so they can get a good piece of art really cheap, because I've already been paid for the piece, I own the rights to it, so I've...
Yeah, that was the cover of Fantasy Hero 4th edition.
Yeah.
That was how they did that.
And it worked as a party fighting and everything, so it worked as a gaming cover. And so sometimes that's a good way for a publisher of a game to get some art cheap.
I'm going to show my game. That's actually how we got the cover for Bulletproof Blues. Storm Cook, who's done a huge amount of work for Hero,
yeah,
and he's one of my favorite gaming artists.
Can I see one of those cards?
Sure. I contacted him, and the days, the 1993, when Magic came out, I was at Gen Con, not as a publisher, but as an author. I had contributed to a fantasy game called Gate War, which you've never heard of, so don't worry about it. But that's why I was there. I was, you know, sitting at the Escape Ventures table, shilling, you know, the game that I'd helped write. And we're wandering around, and the floor is just covered with bodies. It's like an epidemic, except they're all flipping cards and moving little pieces of glass around. But I've gotten off the track. Oh, anyway, Storm Cook, Hero Games. The days of that time period when you could have a game, and our game that we published the following year sold like tens of thousands of copies, which is at the time was a very... very modest success for a role-playing game.
Today would be a phenomenal.
Now would be a runaway hit. So the days of being able to recoup the costs of art, you know, without worrying about it, have come and gone.
Yeah.
So for this, I knew up front the chances of recouping really good art, you know, like Mr. Elmore, virtually zero. It'd basically just be a vanity project. I'd be throwing money into it just to see my name on a cover of a book with really pretty art. So I talked to Storm Cook and I said, is there something you've already got, you know? And he's like, well, actually, as a matter of fact, I do.
Yeah.
And he's like, here's some stuff, you know, because I described to him what kind of game it was. Here's some stuff that looks, you know, sounds kind of like what you're talking about.
Yeah.
What do you think? And he gave us a really good price on it because it's a piece of art he had already done. And so that worked out for him. He got some money, you know, out of the blue for something he didn't have to do fresh.
Right.
And I got a beautiful piece of art for... way less than it would have cost otherwise. So
yeah,
we
did the same thing when we published the Hero System 6th Edition rulebook. We had a lot of artists we'd worked with, and we were like, you know, this is the first time we're doing a color book. It's a multi-genre role-playing game, so we don't have to have setting-specific or even genre-specific art. You know, so what do you have that you haven't sold, that you did for fun, or that you can sell us, you know, second rights to? And we got a lot of really great art, and they got money for it. They didn't have to spend time on it. We had it right away and could flow it into layout immediately. It's a win-win.
Well, it's like there's a board game out now, one of these big box games called Defenders of the Realm.
Sure.
Okay. They came to me and they said, we need a lot of art. We don't have much money at all, so what can we do? I said, well, not much you can do, I guess. And they said, well, we're willing to buy second rights. And I said, okay. And he said, but we need a lot of art, you know. We need a cover, we got cards, we got this, we got that. And I said, how much do you believe in this game? He said, it's good. So we'll play, and the game designer won some awards and said he liked it. He was really, he says, one of his better designed games. And so they had play tested, and they loved it. I said, so you think it'll sell pretty good? And they go, yeah, we're excited, but the art is going to make it or break it. I said, tell you what, let's work up a royalty system. And I said, I've got tons of art that I own the rights to. And I said, and sometimes I just need little pieces of landscapes. I said, I do tons of landscapes, so we can just go end up painting something and get two pieces. And I said, I'll furnish you all the art. And I had a piece that was a perfect cover that I own the rights to. Never been published.
Yeah, I remember seeing that.
And they like, oh, that'd be great. And so I said, I forgot what it was, 10% of whatever we worked out, wholesale, retail. But I knew I was going to get about $1 a game for the first 10,000. But selling 10,000, But they were really confident. And so I said, it costs you nothing right now. But when you start selling, you give me, that royalty or a percentage. And they agreed to it. So I furnished them tons of art. The whole game was my art. And then the only thing I painted new was a game board. I did that in one weekend. It's just landscapes and rivers and looking down on it. No big deal. And so far, I've made really good off of it. I get a royalty check every quarter. And it's doing good, and they keep selling. They've expanded to another expansion, use my art again. And I'm now getting a little royalty off of that. So sometimes if the artists will work together with the company on a good game and do a royalty-based system, you get paid back. Besides, if it's all the art you already been paid for before, it's all profit to you. So if they sell 10,000 copies, I'm getting $1 a copy, fine, you know, no big deal. It's great. It's extra money. I didn't have to do new paintings for that.
Similarly, if an artist is really interested in your project, sometimes you can cut a deal just because they want to do it.
Yeah.
When we were publishing Pulp Hero 6 or 7 years ago, we thought we wanted to get a really striking pulp cover, so what do you do when you want a really striking pulp cover? You call Michael Kaluta. And so we called Michael Kaluta, and at the time he was getting $2,000 to $3,000 a pop to do covers for DC Comics. And we could only afford to pay, I think $1,500 was the max we could afford to pay for a cover. But he was so intrigued by the idea of the role-playing game and getting to do pulp art again, which he hadn't done for a while, but is very well known for, that he was willing to work with us. And then a week later, he realized, wait a minute, I already promised White Wolf I'd do this cover for them by this same deadline. I'm sorry, guys, I can't do two paintings at once. And so we missed out on the chance to have Michael Kaluta art, which would have been great. But I absolutely understand, he's got to go with the things he's already contracted to do. But because he really liked the project, he was willing to cut us a deal for roughly half of what he could have gotten from DC / Warner Brothers.
We've got a few minutes left, but I wanted to see if anybody had questions. Either if you're planning to publish a game, do you have a question about how to how to find and hire an artist, or if you're a gamer who's always wondered about a piece of art? Anybody? Hey. They have done them. They did a coloring book way back when.
That's cool. Have you ever thought about, approach to...
Well, I've kicked off the line for the Pick-A-Path books back then, the TSR. Yeah, they're called Pick-A-Paths?
They were called Choose Your Own Adventure.
Choose Your Own Adventure? Oh.
Rose Estes wrote a bunch of them.
You read and then you decide to go to another page. And I always got killed. I did a few of those. I made the wrong first decision usually was about death. But I did like the first six covers of those, kicked off that line. It was very successful for a while. And it was geared to, smart 10-year-olds, 8 to 10-year-olds up to 14, 15-year-olds, depending on how much you want to do it. But we handled it just like a regular TSR product. I didn't try to paint down to it. I just painted like I was doing a box cover. So we didn't childrenize it, But we just made sure we didn't, especially we avoided, they wanted to avoid a lot of violence and sex on the cover. Well, they always did. And I got to the point, we couldn't paint. If we showed blood on the cover, it had to be green. Couldn't put red blood.
Mentioning the TSR Dungeons & Dragons coloring book brings up something that Brendan mentioned earlier that I wanted to touch on just for fun. Early in gaming, most games only had line art. And that was certainly true of all the early Champions books before I was owner of the company. And so when we took over, we wanted to try to improve the quality of the art a little bit. And for our main Champions Villains book, we had grayscale art, a higher quality grayscale art. And we actually had some fans get really, really upset about this, because for years they had used the gaming supplements as coloring books. They would color in the line art to represent, you know, it says that this part of the costume is red and this part is blue and this is a gold symbol. And they'd take colored pencils or crayons or markers or what have you and color it in. And they were pissed because you can't color in grayscale art.
Yeah.
And I'm like, there's just no pleasing anybody.
I colored in the fourth edition Mechanon.
Yeah.
The guy who had kind of like the Cylon, the old style Cylon looking head with like the bat wings on the side of his head.
Yeah.
I have that guy. I colored that in that guy.
The reason that everything was done in line art is it was cheaper and a printer could not screw it up.
Yeah, printing grayscale was harder.
Went back then, if you did a pencil drawing, it's like rolling the dice. It could come out looking pretty good, or it could come out looking horrible. It was all up to the printer. I mean, the knowledge of that individual person making the plates and burning.
Yeah, because the black belt is the ink density.
Yeah.
If it's a little too heavy, it's mud.
It's black.
If it's
a
little
like a
too white, it's got empty space.
Copy, you know, those are copies. And so, it's rolling the dice. So, if you did good line art, then you know you were 95% sure it's going to reproduce about what you drew. It was safe. And then when computers came along and everything, then you could start doing continuous tone grayscale. And it came out good. So that really, but all the way up until the time of computers, that's why line art everywhere is line art, because the printer couldn't hardly screw it up. But grayscale, ha ha. You might as well put a gun to your head, you know, like play Russian roulette, because that's what it is.
Have you ever done any illustration for anything related to kids?
Actually, yeah, it's funny you mentioned that came up. I recently got approached about doing a story. The title is called PJ Bottoms, and I'm going to be doing the artwork for that, the cover. So, yeah.
Now, do you alter? He did not alter significantly his artistic style for that audience. Actually,
in this case, I am going to. I've learned kind of just through the years that like a lot of my fantasy prints do really well in certain markets, whereas I've got kind of more of a cutesy look, almost an anime. I don't want to say anime because I'm not a huge fan of anime, but you know, the big eye style of you know, doing you know, having kids, I do a lot of like little drawings for the kids and send them in their lunch boxes and stuff like that. So it's almost like I do have two different styles that I can kind of fall back on, and one is that, you know, kind of classic fantasy look, and the other one is more of a cutesy kitty look of a style. So in this case, I think I am going to go with more of a, you know, more, you know, the cuter one. So.
Do you have like one last question before we wrap up? Anybody? You? Anybody want a parting comment?
No, I think I'm good.
No? All right. Well, this has been Larry Elmore, Jason Oliveira. To my left, Steve Long. I'm Brandon Blackmore. I'm nobody. And thank you guys for coming, and I hope it's been interesting.
Thank you.